This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Wheelchair tennis brings those with disabilities together to play with able-bodied people. Jason Allen heads wheelchair tennis for the U.S.
The only difference between able-bodied tennis and wheelchair tennis is that wheelchair tennis athletes can have two bounces.
GLT's Willis Kern reports on the growing sport of wheelchair tennis. Plus, John Norton talks with musicians from the Twin Cities about what makes a good performance space. And Mayor Chris Koos of Normal drops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Normal Town Council has approved buying land for a new East Side fire station and signaled that next year's tax levy will be about the same as this year. Mayor Chris Koos joins us to talk about that and other issues. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Good to be here.
Residents in the area of Hershey and Shepherd Roads are expressing concern about noise and light pollution from a new fire station there. What can the town do to address that?
Well, I think we had a very good discussion on that last night, Charlie, that, talking to some of the residents afterwards, they felt a little more comfortable and had a better understanding of what might or might not be there. The fire station will house maybe six firemen and two vehicles. The runs that run out of that fire station are probably the lightest of the three fire stations, although that could change. But it was done to improve our response time to areas like Mercy Creek Retirement Home and
Normal Community
High School from about 9.5 minutes to 6 minutes. And 6 minutes is kind of our benchmark for the longest we should be away from a person or a house needing assistance.
How does that tweak the areas now served by the College Avenue fire station, which would go away? What does it do to response time in the middle of the town then?
We asked that of the chief last night. He wasn't firm on that. But did say until all three fire stations are located, we won't have the level of service everywhere in the community that we need to have.
So where would the third fire station go, and what's the timeline for that?
The third fire station would be more north. And the timeline on that, I would say probably 5 years.
Is the projected growth in the town going to accommodate that? I mean, it's a balance between what is already on the ground and what you think is going to happen. Is that with growth slowing down in the community, is that going to be needed?
It will be needed because there is so much land in that area that's been annexed and is identified as single family that has yet to be built. So any new growth in the community is going to happen within our corporate boundaries.
What would happen to the College Avenue location?
We're unsure of what's going to happen with that. Right now I think they're using it for storage and classrooms and things like that. Long-term plan, we really haven't decided what we're going to do with it.
Is that something that the town would want to keep and use, or is that something that could be used for private development? I mean, the slope of the land is significant, so it might not be all that great for development.
Yeah,
who knows?
It's a question we haven't answered for ourselves. In terms of a facility, if we decided we weren't going to use it as a facility, it would certainly make sense to declare the property surplus and sell it. It could be commercial, it could be residential.
A couple of years ago, talks broke down on sharing management staffing and perhaps costs on a new East Side fire station with the city of Bloomington. You and other town officials said at the time that Normal would work its plan since Bloomington was not in a position to advance that ball at the time, and since the union and city regulation hurdles were different and sizable between the two municipalities. With this new step by the town, is there an opportunity to revive those talks or not?
You know, in the short term, I would say probably not. And a lot of it had to do with union issues and the way there is differences in the way that Bloomington responds to a call and Normal responds to a call. And the fire chiefs of both cities said, you know, with that in mind, it didn't look like it was going to be a good fit.
So how does a fire station at Shepherd and Hershey fit with Bloomington's fire station placement and coverage, since you're all under mutual aid anyway?
You know, I think this will affect the future placement if Bloomington decides to move something. You know, where we were going to place it, there was a possibility we could cover some of the areas that Bloomington was deficient in covering, and probably deficient's not the right word.
But had longer response times,
right,
on.
Exactly.
Okay. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. Also at last night's meeting, you dealt preliminarily, although the final word on that will on the tax levy will come in December. What is the thinking behind holding the levy static at the same dollar amount? Amounted just under $13 million.
You know, since I've been mayor, and actually, I think the decision we made the decision when I was on council that we would do a flat levy on our property tax, and identifying most of that those dollars for police and fire pension funding. This year, it's looking like our gross EAV is going to come in a little bit higher, which is pushing the rate that the taxpayer pays down a little bit. The projection is $7.5-$8 per $150,000 household as a reduction in property tax.
And that is only a 1 year holding it steady.
That's exactly right.
And why is that?
Because part of that had to do with some of the staff reductions that we had. In terms of funding our IMRF pensions, you know, we had 20-some people less this year than we did last year. Although we have identified through our retreat, and I know we're going to talk about that a little bit, that maybe it was too severe in some areas and we may need to do a little restaffing to accommodate the workload.
Well, let's move on to that retreat then. Mm-hmm. The council and staff held a two-day retreat to set priorities for the next few years. It's part of an annual planning and centering exercise to sort of paint the direction for the town in the next 1 to 5 years. You mentioned that there's some thought that the cuts had been too severe. In what areas has service been jeopardized by a lack of institutional capacity?
The one that the council was most concerned about was communication, communicating to our residents, getting information out to our residents, getting the correct information out to our residents. Because we eliminated that position, there's a little concern on council that maybe we need to bring somebody back in. And part of that, Pamela Reese, the city manager, is looking at some configurations that maybe a position would be created that would be partially communications and other duties within the administration.
Like what other duties?
Possibly economic development. She's not quite sure on what she wants to do with that.
You mentioned getting the correct information out. How is the incorrect information getting out now?
Social media is very, very much responsible for putting some horrible information out there. The one that we're fighting right now is the notion that the town of Normal is spending $30 million on the Trailside East project, which is not true. That's the cost of the project. We're spending about $4.5 million in future property tax rebates through the TIF. But there's a notion out there that we're spending $30 million, and that's just not accurate.
So traditional ways of disseminating information don't cut it anymore for the town?
Social media is more important. things through our website. We have started a page that was dedicated to correcting misconceptions out there. I don't think that page is being maintained currently, but it's important that we can get information to our citizens and the general public in an efficient manner and broad-based.
How many municipalities do this?
Surprisingly, quite a few. This is not new. Communications as a significant discipline within a city government is very important. And, you know, it covers a lot of ground. I mean, it gets information to citizens that they want, in terms of, you know, what are police issues in the community, what are traffic issues, where's the road construction. You know, that's some of the day-to-day stuff that a good communications effort would blast out to the residents of the community. And people want that information. You know, certain people don't want it all, but, you know, there are certain people that want to know what police statistics are every month.
The town's a large organization, so, you know, you mentioned police, you mentioned roads, there's also fire, there's mm-hmm. also economic development. All of these areas of town responsibility are not likely to have equal expertise by a single communication person. Do you want to push the social media activity down to the department level?
Well, I think a communications person would gather that information from the department level, kind of being the gatekeeper of that information, if you will. You're absolutely right. That information has to come from individual departments. And so somebody who would be managing communications would be gathering that information and putting out accordingly.
Does the town have a social media policy?
We do. Don't ask me what it is.
Okay. Does it need tweaking?
We always look at it. We have a very strong Facebook and Instagram presence, updated 3-4 times a week, talking about current issues within the city, events that are going on in the city, whether the city's doing them or some private entity is doing them. So we have a pretty robust presence.
Are there other areas the town will be adding staff in?
Not at this point, only in the sense of replacing retirees.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Mayor Chris Koos of the Town of Normal, recapping the council meeting and talking about the recent retreat to set priorities for the town. What are the major challenges that the council members identified in that retreat over the next 5 years?
Communications, again, was one that had a high level of concern. Community growth. Community tax structure in terms of future sales tax revenues, the dwindling of utility tax revenues. You know, everybody that had a landline 10 years ago, there was a small utility tax on that, and it was an important funding issue for us, and that's gone away. So what does the funding mix look like going forward? And then what services do we need to be sure to enhance or improve or maybe reduce based on what's happening in the community?
In terms of capital needs and build-out and uptown and versus east side, what's the sense of the council on where to put your eggs, the limited number of eggs that you have to place?
You know, uptown has gotten a lot of focus, but since I've been mayor, there's been significant development on Veterans Parkway. There's been significant development at Rab Road and Main Street. So, you know, we're not just a one-horse one-horse effort here in the community. We look at the community in a broader sense. Capital needs are going to be very tough because of tight revenues, but that's something that we're looking at. You know, we have a five-year community improvement plan, capital improvement plan, I'm sorry, which is looking at roads, concrete roads, asphalt roads, water mains, sewer systems. You know, all that has to be maintained, and we can't fall behind on that.
Is that something the town would acquire more debt, willingly acquire more debt to accomplish?
Reluctantly, if we did, we are adverse to debt on those kind of projects. That's why we plan out 5 years. We We have in the past done very low interest loans through the EPA to do some of this work. It just depends on the project, Charlie.
The thinking, though, is that if you're building, if you're refurbishing infrastructure that's going to last a century, then it's not just the current folks who ought to be paying the bill for it. It ought to be future folks who are paying the bill.
I agree. And, you know, there can be rate structures in terms of that. And our finance department is very good at coming up with that, working with consultants. So if we have a $2.50 monthly rate increase to improve the sewers, that is projected out over 20, 25 years.
Okay. What about the underpass?
What about the underpass, Charlie?
Will that come to fruition? Is that a priority for the current council?
It is a priority for the current council, but, you know, as I've said many times, and any council member will tell you, it's going to take significant federal dollars for that to come forward.
There seemed to be some appetite for aggressively pursuing that still at the federal level. Is that a fruitless errand, though, given the current climate in Washington? Or is that something that is really achievable?
That's what they told us years ago when we said Uptown Station had to be funded by federal dollars. I'm confident that at some point that it will get federal funding. I don't know if it's going to be this year, next year, 3 years out. If you recall Uptown Station, we were 9-10 years into trying to accrue funding to make that project work. So it's a long game to do that. I will say that, you know, we've heard that our last Tiger Grant application, our project made it all the way to the Secretary's desk. And we've been told that the people at DOT thinks it's a very good project, that it has a lot of merit. So we're hopeful.
Okay. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal about the recent retreat by the town council. One of the directions you gave to city staff was to create a service and cost reduction plan in case revenues do not remain relatively stable. Mm-hmm. How likely is that, do you think? Or is that just prudent planning?
That was a very spirited discussion because, you know, the council wasn't in complete agreement on what that looked like. Was that just we need to do a 5% across the board every department cut? Or do we need to look more at actual services? Are they still relevant to today's city? You know, we've done this exercise in the past where we've eliminated positions or programs because we felt they're no longer relevant. And so it was more of a discussion that the council wanted to know the process a little more that the town staff goes through in terms of budgeting and why this program was funded and why this program wasn't. And they want a little bit better information of how that works so they have a better understanding.
When will that come back to council, and how seriously is that just a contingency plan, or do you think significant cuts will be needed?
I don't see it as a contingency plan or a direction to significant cuts. I see more of a communication between staff and the council so that the council better understands.
So are we doing the right things?
Right.
Okay. You also want a fleet vehicle and leasing report.
Yes.
Why that?
Traditionally, we have funded vehicle replacement through a vehicle replacement fund. In other words, let's say we bought a pickup truck this year and we said the life of that pickup truck is 7 years. Well, every year, we fund 1/7 of that to the vehicle replacement fund. So what we're looking at now, because of tight budgets and revenues, is 7 year the right number for that? Is it maybe 10 years? And also, in the life of a vehicle or a piece of equipment, if it's a shorter lifespan, is it better to lease that piece of equipment or buy that piece of equipment? So I think that's what the deep dive will be about.
Should you be buying electric now that the battery lives are longer?
You know, it's something we're considering. Yes, you know, we're very pro electric, in the sense of what we did with EV Town and with Rivian coming into the community. But there's got to be a cost benefit.
The CEO of Rivian recently at an EDC banquet mentioned that ownership patterns are going to be changing over the next 20 to 30 years, that it may not make a lot of sense for companies or individuals to own where they can rent or charge by a given unit of use. Is that something that municipalities should look at, or are town usages relatively fixed?
Well, you know, I think there's opportunity there, Charlie. There really is. I mean, let's take a piece of equipment X that the city of Bloomington has and the town of Normal has, and if we're using that piece of equipment 20% of the life cycle of the equipment, then maybe it makes sense to do it on a subscription basis with Bloomington and Normal and maybe Pontiac or some other community. But that's going to require the market to be able to supply at that level. You know, and what R.J. Skorin said, instead of lease or Uber model, you know, he talked about a subscription model that people would be subscribing to vehicle use depending on their needs.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mayor Chris Coos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from A Perfect Promotion, providing value to a company's marketing strategy through personalized apparel and promotional giveaways. They can put logos on anything. A Central Illinois company with more than 26 years of experience, they take pride in customer service. More info at aperfectpromotion.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, wheelchair tennis. Willis Kern has a report. As voters go to the polls today, state and federal officials say they're more ready than ever for potential cyber interference with American voting systems. Cybersecurity expert Teresa Payton says that's because the 2016 election served as a wake-up call. Payton was the first woman to serve as the White House's chief information officer during the George W. Bush administration. During visits to Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan universities last week, Payton told GLT's Ryan Denham that states like Illinois got millions in federal grant money for election-related cybersecurity upgrades and training.
A lot of briefings have been held by Department of Homeland Security with each of the states. It is optional, though. The states' rights, that's the way the United States is set up. So the states can opt in or out of applying for grants and opt in or out on briefings with Department of Homeland Security. But as far as I know, most of the states that had irregularities during the presidential election cycle have welcomed DHS, and all of the states in some form or fashion have participated either in conference calls, threat intelligence sharing, learnings from the ethical hackers. So there's a lot of awareness. Does that mean we're perfect and we've done everything we needed to do in a short period of time? No. But I think the wake-up call has been there, and everybody's been working pretty fast and furious to try and answer security vulnerabilities that we know.
Well, you're speaking on two college campuses today. I wanted to ask if you think the American education system is doing enough to get people into the cybersecurity, information security fields, especially women and people of color. I wonder, is there more we could be doing to make sure that we have all those positions filled?
I think we've done a lot. And so please don't take this the wrong way. I really do believe, especially the college and university systems, I get asked all the time by deans and teachers and presidents of colleges and universities, are we doing the right thing? Are we headed the right way? And so that the energy, the attention, and the focus is there. We've actually lost them in grade school, middle school, and high school. And so I encourage my team to get out in the community. I get out in the community and talk, just have conversations with kids to recruit them. And we need everybody, male, female, and all, you know, from a diversity perspective, all different walks of life and backgrounds. It's not just ethnicity. We need everything. So if we're going to come up with the right solutions to design for the human, we need humans from all walks of life, right, to help design for the human. And what's interesting is the pressure that we have put on our grade school, middle school, and high schoolers to perform. And let me tell you how this plays out. So I'm going to paraphrase because I've heard this multiple times, multiple ways. So I'm going to just paraphrase for them. So I'll say, well, how many of you have ever thought about a career in cybersecurity and intelligence operations? Very few people will raise their hand. So then I'll tell them a couple really cool stories of things that I have been able to experience where I've seen, you know, kind of evil in the world, and my team and I have been able to right that wrong, regard whether it's been for, you know, government, something I could talk about that's not classified, whether it's for a business or for an individual. And I talk about like what a noble cause it is and how there's all these different roles that you can play. You could be law enforcement, U.S. military, you could be private sector, you can be government. And so then I'll say to them, okay, so now that you've heard what you can do, what do you think? And I have had kids as young as sixth grade say to me, I haven't had any exposure to this prior to now. And I can't afford to fail. Now is not the time to experiment. I'm like, now is exactly the time in your life to experiment. What do you have to lose? What do you mean fail? Like, my job is different now than it was a year ago. As long as you're willing to kind of learn and put in the time and be passionate about what you do, you know, what I learned years ago in school did not prepare me for what I do today. It's what I learned last week that prepares me for today and next week. And so there's this perspective in young people, and I hear this, whether it's the public school system or the private school system. So we're losing them. And I go back to, okay, so how did I get here? And my dad was in the Marine Corps. I had to transfer schools in the middle of high school, not uncommon for Marine Corps brats to do. And when I transferred schools, I ended up at a Department of Defense school. It was mandatory to take computer programming. I don't know if I would have taken computer programming if it wasn't mandatory. And I got in there, and I loved it, and I was good at it. And there wasn't a now's not the time to experiment kind of thing, right? It was just there, and it was expected. And that started me on a path of where I am today. Had I not been in a situation where I had to take the class, I don't know if I would or not. So I go back to, we need to be asking ourselves, what's the branding issue? What's the marketing issue? And why are people not opting in? And then once they opt in, why do they not stay? And we need to get to that root cause.
Well, this next question may get a little close to your classified line that you can't cross, do your best with it. The New York Times reported last week that Chinese spies have been listening into President Trump's unsecured iPhone calls. That was leaked by those around him who think he's being a little bit too cavalier with electronic security. So what advice would you give to this administration or future administrations when it comes to how cautious to be with this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, and so on that one, it was. Alleged. So we'll kind of leave it at that, right? So there's a little bit of kind of very well thought out hypothesis around potentially Russia and China surveilling these phone conversations. And I think that's a very reasonable hypothesis to have. So we'll kind of leave it at that so we don't go too far down a field. But what I would say is, and I have heard the president on the record say he understands that his cell phone conversations may or may not be secure, and that he understands that, and he has the White House military office that actually helps with classified and secured communications. Now, in the course of doing business, presidents will use personal lines, right? So you kind of walk that fine line. But what I would say is whether it's the president of the United States, an executive at a company, a military official, a law enforcement official, the technologies that we have in our hand that seem like they should be secure, we know there's glitches. And there's different potential points of intrusion, right? So the cellular signal of the carrier itself can be hard to replicate and to surveil, but not impossible. But you have to have motive, you have to have means, you have to have capability. You have to have proximity in order to be able to do that, right? So you have to say, I'm going to mimic a cell tower today, and this is how I'm going to do it, and I hope to catch your phone call when I mimic this cell tower, right? At least as it relates to the United States. In other countries that own the telco, there's a whole nother, availability and access that's afforded potentially for different types of covert and potentially nefarious activities. Whether or not that means that a government-owned telco is used for that, that's that's, again, a whole nother matter. But then there's other points of intrusion, such as, are you connected to a Wi-Fi network that's not completely secure? Or there's a rogue Wi-Fi hotspot named the same thing as that network that you think you know and love and trust, but it's actually not really them. Is your iCloud or your Google, your Droid account, that cloud account, is that secure? Are you using that for messaging and not realizing that your messages transverse through that cloud account? So if it's through the cloud versus through the cellular company, there could be an interception point there as well. And so there's these points of digital connections and digital tracks that are created in our comms that may or may not have anything to do with that cellular signal that I had a phone call on. It can also be Google Home and Alexa. There could be voice assistants where you're having the conversation. There could be, you know, web browsers that you just looked at to get up to speed on what you're getting ready to talk about, right? So as it relates to that, my advice would be, if you do need to use your smartphone for confidential conversations, whether you're the president of the United States or an executive or the president of a university, consider using encrypted apps. So check your surroundings. Turn off Wi-Fi. Turn off Bluetooth on your phone. Check your surroundings. And then consider using encrypted apps such as Signal or Threema. And, you know, there's certainly other ones that you can use as well. Those, for me personally, are ones that I use.
That's Teresa Payton speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. Payton was the White House's chief information officer from 2006 to 2008 during the end of the Bush administration. She spoke last week at Illinois Wesleyan and Illinois State Universities as part of their Adlai Stevenson Memorial Lecture Series.
On the next Radio Lab, what's going on inside our guts?
25 feet of coiled, soiled, fetid tubing.
Corned beef.
Meat and bread and coffee.
Salt. Pastrami sandwich.
Mini burgers.
It's steamy.
I don't know, it's like bubbly.
What kind of disgusting?
But fascinating.
Thousands of species that are living inside of you and preying on each other.
The mysteries of the human gut, this week on Radio Lab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Wheelchair tennis has been around more than four decades, but has only recently come to Bloomington Normal. GLT's Willis Kern has more on a demonstration event in the Twin Cities.
Okay, we'd like to get started. I am thrilled that we have this many people and this many folks in chairs to play. We're going to start off with a demonstration.
Sue Ann Guess Hansen has never used a wheelchair, but the retired Metcalf school teacher worked with many children who did. So she naturally wants to see people with disabilities succeed in all facets of life, including sports. As a current volunteer for the United States Tennis Association's Midwest Diversity Wheelchair and Adaptive Tennis Program, Guess Hansen decided to organize a wheelchair tennis demonstration event in Bloomington. 50 people, some in wheelchairs, show up at Evergreen Racquet Club. A team of four wheelchair tennis players and a coach have traveled from Western Indiana to show how wheelchair athletes can compete with their so-called able-bodied colleagues, some of whom are teammates, others opponents. There have been wheelchair tennis players in Bloomington before, but Colleen Curran, Evergreen Racquet Club's general manager, says this demonstration event marks a turning point for the club.
We are community service oriented, and we also have a strong belief in tennis for everyone, all-inclusive, no matter abilities, levels, age. This fits in perfectly into our mission and what we'd like to offer to members of the community.
Participation by athletes in wheelchairs has skyrocketed worldwide, increasing 11-fold since fewer than 400 took part in the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. According to Paralympic.org, there were nearly 4,300 wheelchair athletes at the London Olympics in 2012 and about 4,350 at Rio in 2016. The sport of wheelchair tennis was the brainchild of Californian Brad Parks, who worked with friends to establish a competitive program after a skiing accident left him paralyzed from the hips down.
In 1980, 4 years after my accident,
started this national organization to promote wheelchair tennis and get more people to know about it and just give it a shot to see if you could develop a sport from nothing and kind of grew into what it is today.
Today, there are more than 50,000 wheelchair tennis players around the world. In addition to the Paralympic Games, there are wheelchair championships associated with all four Grand Slam tennis tournaments. Parks is among the most decorated wheelchair tennis players ever, holding the sport's number one ranking during the 1980s and winning three Grand Slam titles and a gold medal at the 1992 Barcelona Paralympics.
When we started sport, we felt like, how do we tell people about a sport that they'd never heard of? Most people think it's impossible to play back in those days. So the best way to do that is through these demonstrations. And you get a couple of great players, they demonstrate, maybe help out with a clinic, and you teach people how to play. And that's how the sport grows. So I think they're critical.
There are nearly 200 competitive events worldwide that regularly schedule U.S. professional tennis players. Jason Allen, who heads up wheelchair tennis for the USTA, says one reason is, besides using wheelchairs, the game doesn't change much.
The only difference between able-bodied tennis and wheelchair tennis is that wheelchair tennis athletes can have two bounces. Everything else is the same. So we are completely integrated into the able-bodied world.
This slight rule variation allows wheelchair athletes to compete on the same court and in the same match as able-bodied players. Sherry Hildebrand is an instructional assistant professor in therapeutic recreation at Illinois State University and helped organize the demonstration event in Bloomington. She says the smooth integration of wheelchair players makes the sport inclusive.
I could be in a wheelchair playing wheelchair tennis, and my partner playing doubles with me could be standing. You don't have to have just wheelchair tennis or just standing tennis. You can have up-down tennis where you've got a person with a wheelchair and person without a wheelchair playing together on the same team.
My name is Julia Farrell. I want to become famous, and please make my dream come true. Thank you.
14-year-old Julia Farrell tinkered on her phone while her dad, Kevin, drove the 88 miles to Bloomington from Hinckley in DeKalb County. Kevin Farrell says Julia has spina bifida, the birth defect where there is incomplete closing of the backbone and membranes around the spinal cord. He says it limits her mobility.
But here, with the wheelchair, she can be like anybody else and play like anybody else, because she has a very, she's very strong, she's very cool. Coordinated.
Oh. Ready? Here we go.
Yeah. Oh, look at that.
Look at that. Excellent. Good job. Just the fact that you're moving the wheelchair and then able to get to the ball and stroke and hit it is really good.
One of the demonstration team players lets Julia borrow her wheelchair while running the 14-year-old through a set of basic drills. Dawn Crawford of Schurville, Indiana, suffered a spinal cord injury from a fall in 2000. She started playing wheelchair tennis about 10 years ago as a way to enjoy sports with her children. Crawford says Julia seems a natural for the sport because she's so well coordinated.
She cannot move well, so for her to be in a wheelchair playing tennis would be better. She won't be able to get any balls standing. So if she's in a chair, so she has to learn the movement of the chair, and then she combines that with the strokes that she knows, and she's on her way.
Julia's dad, Kevin, who has taught tennis, wonders about things like wheelchair costs and access to programs and other players. But Dawn Crawford says grants can help pay for equipment, and if Julia wants to play with just about anybody else, there's nothing to stop her.
There are players out there that have started young and played from, say, her age on, and they've played on their high school teams as a wheelchair player against able-bodied kids. So it is possible.
Some observers of wheelchair tennis say the player's ability to compete on a court with able-bodied athletes inspires them. But demonstration team coach Julie Fritz says some wheelchair athletes take exception to that notion.
They're just people that happen to sit every day instead of walk. And that's how they see themselves. So being able to play wheelchair tennis is just being able to play tennis to them.
Wheelchair tennis founder Brad Parks agrees with that to a point, but says it's only natural that great athletes are inspirational, especially when they've endured so much.
Some people watch the Olympics because of the up-close and personals, and the up-close and personals in the Paralympics are so much better. It's so much more interesting and inspiring and everything else because of of what these athletes have been through.
Right now, funding and other issues have put the United States behind other nations in competitive wheelchair tennis. But Park says he's hopeful that will change soon.
Right now, the best players are from Europe, but I'd love to see more great Americans come up. And I'd love hearing stories about this 14-year-old gal who is introduced to wheelchair tennis. And that's kind of how the sport grows and develops. And who knows, this gal could end up being, you know, a great American player, but she may not. It may be just being encouragement, but that's the beauty of the sport.
Organizers say they're hopeful this successful demonstration in Bloomington could lead to more events like it, helping spread awareness and the growth of wheelchair tennis. I'm Willis Kern, WGLT News.
If you might have noticed, while the players were playing, when we were just warming up, their chairs were moving a lot when they weren't hitting the ball. There's a reason for that. Have you ever tried to ride a bike on a hill? And if you stop in the middle of the hill, it's hard to get going again. So as a coach, I yell at my players when they're not moving.
Bloomington Normal musicians continue to create new ways to promote their events and are even creating new venues for those performances. Singer-songwriter Sarah Quaz collaborating with Bloomington artist Jan Brandt to promote her show at Night Shop this Saturday night. Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson are collaborating with the Bloomington Print and Design Studio to create a new intimate venue. GLT's John Norton has the story.
It's quite a compliment for the Bloomington duo of Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson, who play regularly around Central Illinois. A couple years ago, they and the owners of Duncan Manor outside Towanda created the highly popular songwriter series that ran two winter seasons.
And then some life changes happened out at Duncan Manor. They welcomed their first child this year, and they decided to maybe turn their focus at the manor towards other types of events, but we wanted to keep doing this format, so we thought, let's bring it somewhere else.
So they worked out a deal with Haphazard Press in downtown Bloomington, the design firm that already has a strong reputation with local, regional, and national musicians for creating stunning posters and artwork, opened doors to its new location last year. Bridges says Haphazard was very open to creating a vibe at their shop similar to the songwriter series at Duncan Manor.
Where we would have seats, limited number of seats, there's 50 chairs that we've gotten there, 50 reservations available for each show, and each reservation includes a poster that they design.
Bridges said each event in what they have christened the Hallowed Hall is designed to be an intimate affair where the artist can banter with audience members in a setup that has the feel of a living room. She said they try to create an atmosphere where the show is an experience from beginning to end.
It kind of has a private event feel. You know, your name is on the guest list at the door, so it feels very exclusive. And you walk away with this custom design memento of your evening, this poster that Haphazard has designed. So you get to experience, again, the music in a way where you can really kind of hang on every note.
Bridges says the Hallowed Hall fits well into the live local original music scene, where venues in downtown Bloomington already include the Castle Theater, Night Shop, Jazz Up Front, and Six Strings Club.
The Hallowed Hall is like kind of a micro venue, I guess. It's something a little bit different.
Unlike the Duncan Manor songwriter series, Bridges and Thompson are targeting songwriters with a regional and even national reputation to play the Hallowed Hall.
So leveraging our own contacts, maybe some of Haphazard's contacts through their work to kind of bring in some different things, and maybe some people who play here on occasion, maybe at the bigger venues, but might be passing through and might want to do something on an off year or an off day where it doesn't really fit for them to be at the Castle or Night Shop, and they want to do something a little bit different.
This is the Belleville, Illinois bluegrass band Old Salt Union. They're next up to play the Hallowed Hall November 17th.
Well, I know all my time's been decided, and I'll be gone just another couple days.
The Duncan Manor songwriter series was a smashing success, selling out most shows well in advance. But Bridges and Thompson knew they wanted to partner with a local business if the series was to continue at a new space. They learned from Duncan Manor that music fans came to shows as much to see the building as they did to listen to the music. They hunched that Haphazard's design reputation would create an extra incentive to buy tickets for the Hallowed Hall shows.
So we wanted to work with a business that that also had their own reach, and we have our own reach. And I know from, we did our first concert last month with Miles Nielsen, and a lot of the attendees said, we didn't even know Haphazard had a retail space. This is awesome. So there's people coming in to downtown now realizing, hey, these are local shops. We can come in, we can buy local made artwork.
The song is called Make Me Yours. It's the brand new single by Bloomington singer-songwriter Sarah Kwan.
Make me yours, make me yours, oh my.
Kwa is also collaborating with a local artist for her November 10th show at Night Shop, where she will debut the single. Jan Brandt created a poster for the event that merges the spirit of the Fillmore East concerts of the 1960s and 70s with the work of Czech painter, illustrator, and graphic artist Alphonse Mucha.
But you can't get them unless you buy a ticket to my show. You go through the ticket hub, brownpapertickets.com, and one of the options is to buy a ticket with a poster. It's an experiment to see if I can't get people excited about the feeling, the style, the tone of the show that we're putting together. We've been working really hard on our set list and the sound and all aspects, even lighting. We're working on all of those things to find out how can we make this special. I am releasing a single, but more than that, I just want to see, what do people want to see? What do they want to hear? What do they want to have? How do I fit in with this community of musicians, and what can I do to keep going?
Kwa is bullish on the Bloomington Normal music scene, but acknowledges especially non-listening rooms such as bars and restaurants struggle to attract an audience on weeknights. Many are busy toting kids to sporting or music events, others at home enjoying a night with Netflix or other online distractions. So Kwa is digging into new ideas.
Everyone will say, if you ask them, what kind of community you want to live in? Because I ask that question a lot. And everyone will say, I just want a place where there's a lot going on, a lot of options, a lot of things to do. I want friends, I want connections. But yet when it comes down to it, they don't go out. And I get it. I want to stay home sometimes too. But in order to create that kind of community, you have to be a part of it. You have to support local businesses.
So Kwa is hoping Jan Brandt's limited edition poster acts as an incentive for fans to buy tickets for the show and hopefully her new single. And she's banking that her partnership with Brandt will allow both to mine each other's demographic, similar to how Stone and Snow and Haphazard Press leverage each other's reach on the Howlett Hall shows. Kwa says it's a natural connection, as Brandt already has her own following in town.
I've used small businesses all throughout the project. First, it was Jan who did the artwork. Cheryl Russell Clark did the photography because I need a high-resolution photo, digital file. Then Christina Reese set the typesetting. Then it's going to go to the copy shop. The show itself is at Night Shop, locally owned music venue, bar in town. And you can add to that, all the musicians in my band are also local professional musicians. My producer, Tony Sanfilippo, his studio is just down the street. Every step of the way, the entire thing, they're all people from our community who are giving their talents to this project.
Jan Brandt says she's somewhat altruistic about this project with Kwa, as she is a huge music fan in general, and especially of Kwa's music. But she's also a maverick of sorts, and that she unabashedly uses non-traditional platforms to sell her art.
Perhaps one of my paintings, a large painting, might be too expensive for a person to purchase, or they don't have the place for it. Well, that doesn't mean I'm going to knock them out of the equation. I'm going to try to have different price points and make it more democratic so that, you know, try to get people in on entry levels of collecting art. Then I create a collector base. It just starts to grow. I do work with companies to add my artwork as designs to printed products, such as I have a yoga clothing line, tote bags, glassware.
Brandt said purists might tut-tut her for selling out by putting her artwork on commercial items, but she views herself as an individualist, and as someone who went back to school in her 50s, she's not concerned what others might think.
I am friends with a lot of my professors, and I talk to many of them, and almost all of them are totally supportive, and they're like, if I'm happy with it and it's a good quality product, then go for it. But then also, it's nobody really has ever been able to tell me what to do. I'm going to make my own decision.
Brandt, like Qua, is bullish on the Bloomington Normal music scene. But for her, this project goes back to her altruism.
My husband and I, when we go hear live music, that's our best times of our marriage, really, you know. And I, when I first met him, he was a drummer in bands. Now he's an attorney. But, you know, we get together and go out to hear live music, and we could be like 21 again. So part of this is, yeah, you know, this is going to broaden people that see my art, and that's wonderful. But the feeling I get when I'm listening to live music, and that specifically we're talking about Sarah playing, I am idealistic about it. I want people to know what that feels like. And I think, you know, the world's a better place if we get out of our homes to enjoy this type of a performance.
Collaboration, whether it's with another business in town to help promote a show or with a venue to create a more welcoming atmosphere for the show itself, isn't the answer to a more vibrant music scene, but it's one way Bloomington Normal musicians are working to sustain that thriving scene. For WGLT, I'm John Norton.
Sarah Kwa's show at Night Shop is this Saturday. You can buy tickets at brownpapertickets.com, where you'll have an array of choices to purchase Jan Brandt's poster and or Sarah Kwa's new single along with the tickets. The next show at the Hallowed Hall at Haphazard Press is November 17th with Belleville. Belleville, Illinois Bluegrass Band, Old Salt Mine. Tickets to that include a commemorative poster and can be purchased through the Hallowed Hall Facebook page. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.